Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's Forum program, former U.S. Senator Gary Hart ran for president twice, rejecting Political Action Committee money both times. Now, the Colorado Democrat is asking candidates for the 2016 presidential race to do the same. In his new book, The Republic of Conscience, Hart writes that donations from corporations and other special interests are corrupting the democratic process more than ever before. He'll join us. You're invited to do the same after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. We're joined in studio this Forum hour by former Colorado Senator and former political candidate Gary Hart, the author of 21 books. He recently published The Republic of Conscience, and it's a book all about the American Republic, what it was meant to be and what it has become. And welcome, Gary Hart, back to Forum.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. This book is in some ways a manifesto, in some ways an indictment. Let's talk first about the indictment, because the Constitution, as you argue, protects us against corruption. That was certainly the founders' view, trying to assure us against corruption, and it's pervasive. It's pervasive throughout our election process and throughout our political process. How do we get to this? How does this republic turn into a lobbying and special interest web of corruption?
It's important, I think, to, first of all, define corruption the way the founders of the country did in the late 18th century. They didn't use the term to denote bribery or money under the table. They used the classic smaller Republican definition of putting special or narrow interests ahead of the common good. And they said that more than anything else would destroy any republic, including the one they were creating. By that definition, we have a massively corrupt government. There are over—
Even on money under the table, we have a massively corrupt government.
Well, that's also true, but that's gone on, Teapot Dome and so on. But we have gone from, I think, 160-some registered lobbyists in the 1970s to over 13,000 today. And virtually half of the former members of Congress are now becoming lobbyists. And that, tied together with the cost of campaigning, is corrupting our government.
Early on in the preface of your book, you say more than 400 former members of Congress, not to mention their spouses and family members who've joined the lobbying ranks, and former administration officials come and go from one administration to another with periods of lobbying activities in between. This is our government. This is the way our government is and the way it operates or doesn't operate because of all its dysfunction. But you also say that all this lobbying and this political class that we have has been at the expense of the middle class and expense of poor people.
That's true, and I draw the comparison to 17th and 18th century England, which our founders got away from, and the division between what was called the court and the country. And the country was composed of what we would call the middle class, farmers and shopkeepers and so forth, and they were a rising force in England at that time. But all the power was consolidated in London and around the court of the king, and the courtiers and influence peddlers and what were called placemen had all the power in the country, and it led to a brief revolution in England.
You mentioned the English, and in your book you talk about, the republics that go back to Greece and Rome, but also the republic idea from England and from Scotland and even from Machiavelli, who sort of resurrected the idea. We tend to think of him, you know, as ends and means and stuff, but he was important in this whole picture. How about establishing the parameters between what's a republic and what's a democracy?
Well, I am not a political scientist. I did get a degree in political theory, so I'll try to simplify. If we walked outside the studio, most San Franciscans would say we are a democracy, and that's correct. And yet the founders created a republic, what most San Franciscans, maybe even Denverites as well, could not do is define what a republic is. And Thomas Jefferson tried to bridge the gap by referring to himself as a democratic republican, which would confuse present-day people a lot. But the four factors of republic since Athens—
Well, that's what Donald Trump is, I guess, isn't he? He's a Republican now, but he was a Democrat registered for years.
I won't go there. Republics have emphasis on popular sovereignty. The people have the power. No king or oligarch. And this, by the way, is a problem if two families are now governing America. Second, a sense of the commonwealth, a sense of the common good. And many of the early states called themselves commonwealths. And third, citizen participation, what they called civic virtue. You have to participate in self-government. And then finally, resistance to corruption. Those were the standards our founders set forth, and we've drifted away from virtually all of those.
We talk about the founders and their intentions, and then people get confused because the Supreme Court, you know, tries to be either strict construction or loose construction, and who knows what. And then you often get into this kind of thorny territory about the founders also essentially giving countenance to slavery and certainly not even recognizing women as being citizens and so forth. How does that all play out in your mind?
Well, I try to deal with this early in the book, briefly anyway. By suggesting return to these basic principles of the republic did not therefore mean endorsing all the exclusionary aspects of the country as it was created. And I talk about how much progress we've made in civil rights, equality for women, and respect for minorities and all the rest of it. And that has been very much a progress in the 20th century. But that we don't need to leave those principles I mentioned behind in our effort to be inclusive, and we have a lot of work to do in that regard.
Talking with former Senator Gary Hart, and he's the author of The Republic of Conscience. That's his new book. And let's talk about how we get out of this mess we're in of corruption, whether you go back to the founders or just the sense that, you know, lobbying and special interests really pretty much are the nature of how work is done on Capitol Hill and throughout the government. And you mentioned, but first let's talk about cover of Time magazine, the new Time magazine, I happen to see it's a Game of Thrones. There's a picture of Bill Clinton and a picture of George W. Bush. And the sense is, in many people's minds, this is dynastic. This is not the way government should be. You see it that way.
Well, the combination of insider systems, intricate insider systems in Washington, which both families have been part of and still are, with networks, Rolodexes shared all over the place, and the same people, as you mentioned, coming in and out of office regularly, closes off talent that's scattered around the country, new ideas, new leadership, and the rest. Now, Barack Obama's an exception to that, of course. But look who the two front runners are, leaving Mr. Trump aside from the moment, are still those two families. And it's all part of, I think, the same system of moving in and out of government into positions of power in the corporate sector. By the way, the leading columnist in America, Tom Friedman, last week on television called it legal bribery. He goes farther than I do. And so The Economist, a conservative business-oriented magazine, had a column 2 or 3 weeks ago talking about how corporate lobbying is corrupting not only the U.S. government, but also the corporations themselves.
Well, we can talk about Citizens United and corporate lobbying and so forth, but also the labor has a lot of lobbying that they've done too, and we can talk about that as well. It's just money has corrupted politics, and McCain-Feingold bill was supposed to help and ameliorate that to some degree. It hasn't. I've used the same terms that Tom Friedman used for many years now because I think it is a form of legal bribery, frankly, the way money has mixed its way into politics. Just wondering, though, I mean, one of the things I admired about you when you were presidential aspirant was you wouldn't take PAC money. And
that's
you
right.
Put that out there now to these candidates. Don't take the PAC money. You know, separate yourself from the money. Falling on absolutely deaf ears, is it not?
Well, I think Senator Sanders has taken the same pledge 30 years later, and I welcome that.
He's the anomaly, yeah.
Yes. You not only have now the traditional PACs, political action committees, that we've had for a long, long time, since the 70s anyway, you now have the super PACs, and the Supreme Court has authorized them. That decision, in my mind, has to be and will be reversed, but it's going to take a while in a new and different court. Let me give you a couple of ideas that we don't pay attention to. Most campaign finance goes to paid media, television and radio, 80 to 90 cents of every campaign dollar. The people of the United States, speaking of the Commonwealth, own the airwaves. They are not owned by NBC or Rupert Murdoch. They're owned by the people of the United States and the networks that license them. We license the network to use them to make money. We should legally require those networks who have a broadcast license to make time available, limited amount of time to qualified candidates to get their message across. And that, more than anything else, would dramatically reduce the cost of campaigning.
And other than maybe some kind of populist quasi-revolution, how can this be brought into fruition? I mean, you know, this idea of taking the money out because the media is public, owned by the airwaves, are owned by the people, and so it's been around for a long time, and it's never really been able to be generated into any direction.
Well, it's because of the intensive lobbying by the broadcast industry.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So it's a cat chasing its tail. They don't talk about it openly, but every network, every cable station, the cable's not regulated, but radio broadcasting has lobbyists in Washington, and they hammer the elected officials against making time available. And I think every Western democracy, so far as I know, makes time freely available to qualified candidates, including Great Britain and most other Western democracies.
I know I can speak probably for thousands of listeners here who would love to see something like this, along with limiting candidate access. Access to candidates because of money, or restricting, for example, that transition from public office. You write about these things into a lobbying role and so forth, but feel the sense of helplessness. Feel, you know, that the game is rigged against them.
Well, this is the frightening thing to me, and why I wrote the book after seeing these changes in the past 25 or 30 years. And they are dramatic changes. They've in some ways happened quickly, but in other ways happened so gradually that most Americans aren't even aware of it. But there is a deepening sense, as you well know and your listeners know, of dissatisfaction in the country. It don't have to be Tea Party or Occupy or anything like that to know the American people are losing confidence in their own government. And if in a democracy, and certainly in a republic, when the people lose confidence in their government, that government's in trouble. Now, I don't see revolution in the streets. I don't see buildings being burned down or anything of that sort, or violence. But when people drop out, it just leaves the power more and more in the hands of the oligarchs in Washington.
Well, I suppose part of – can we talk about the presidential race a little bit?
Sure.
I mean, as a veteran of a few of those yourself and so forth, and certainly a veteran of being on the political scene for many years, people say, well, Donald Trump, very unlikely to be a candidate, and if he runs as an independent, he's only going to hurt the Republicans and probably help. Is it a foregone conclusion on the Democratic side that Hillary Clinton's going to get the nomination in your mind?
No, I don't believe so. I have always been at odds with political journalism over many things, but one thing is their reading of the polls. I was a candidate in 84 against a prohibitive front runner at the time, Vice President Walter Mondale, and he routinely got 50% in the polls or more, slightly more. And the journalists said in the year before, 83 summer and fall, Mondale's the nominee, and he turned out to be the nominee because of the superdelegates at the convention here. But I took a different view. I said 50% of the Democratic Party are looking for someone else. And I see the same thing now with Secretary Clinton. She is virtually universally known. She doesn't have to get known anymore. She does have extraordinarily high negative ratings among voters at large.
Distrust. Yeah, and the polls show.
And as you well know, nobody's ever, with high negatives, has ever been able to drive those down. So I see 40 to 45% of the Democratic Party still looking for someone else and as yet not totally committed.
You knew Martin O'Malley and have high regard for him?
He's not well known, and in some odd ways he is sort of in the position I was 30 years ago, 31 years ago, former mayor of Baltimore, two terms, former mayor, governor of Maryland, two terms, 50 years old, a new voice, new ideas, new approaches, new generation. And I think that's important as well. He's at 5 or 6 or 7% in the polls. But if he were to, say, upset Secretary Clinton in one of the early states, it's an entirely new race.
Or Bernie Sanders could upset, or maybe even not upset, maybe even beat in New Hampshire Secretary Clinton.
Quite possibly, and then that changes the race totally.
Well, you know, Trump is kind of taking a lot of the oxygen out of this race. There's a big debate on August 6th of 10 Republican candidates. And, you know, for example, in reading your book, you're talking about the surveillance state and foreign intervention and a lot of things that you feel have gone too far. And suddenly, you know what I was thinking? Rand Paul. He's saying the same things that Gary Hart's saying about the surveillance state going too far and about foreign intervention going too far.
Well, when that begins to happen, when liberal, so perceived liberals and people on the right begin to share common views, for example, the story today about overpopulation in our prisons, that's bringing the right and the left together. Something has to be done. The growth since 1947 of first what I call the national security state with all the panoply that involves, the growth of the surveillance state with a exploding intelligence community network, and the expeditionary state, the sense that we have to send troops. We still have 800 bases abroad. We have 170 military bases in Germany. People are beginning to say, why? What to do what? To keep the Germans down or what?
And the special interest state, as you call it, which is...
Well, Eisenhower, the prophet, said watch out, and he turned out to be right.
So, you know, a year ago at this time, as a number of people have pointed out, talking about not trusting the polls, I think it was Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain who were ahead in the polls. So a lot of this whole phenomenon about Trump is being trumped up to ridiculous proportions. But the fact of the matter is that there's something about him that clearly appeals to a certain segment of the American people within the Republic, and they see him as being decisive, and they see him as being maybe a strong, independent figure and all of that sort of thing. But what does it tell you about all of the attention on him? I mean, there are people who are saying, gee, I can't wait till that debate because I want to hear what Trump's going to say, as opposed to thinking about the policy issues.
He is a media phenomenon, but that's not all of it. There is a radical, in times of stagnation or frustration, if you just viewing the 230 years of American history, a radicalization of certain elements of our society occurs one way or the other, far left, far right, or somewhere in between. And there is such unhappiness, discontent, anger at stalemate in Washington and ideological rigidity and orthodoxy in thinking, particularly on the right, that people are just saying enough already. I'm going to go to a rally for Donald Trump. He obviously isn't taking questions from people who don't like him. Occasionally the press gets to shout a question. But I think, as you said earlier, when the chips are down, he will not be a serious candidate for president. The interesting question that you raise is he going to upset the apple cart and so tilt debates that it's going to cause huge confusion in the Republican Party, and I think that's quite possible.
Well, he's already caused huge confusion by dint of the fact that he has hit this major issue of immigration and particularly undocumented or illegal immigration. And there's been attempts by candidates like Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush to essentially get the Hispanic vote by moving more soft on immigration and moving toward at least what's seen as a compromise as opposed to Trump's rhetoric. I mean, that's at least how I read it, and that seems to be what he's managed to get into here or arouse in terms of the citizenry. How do we arouse the citizenry, though? I mean, you're raising some really important issues here in this book, and get them. We need new leadership. We need, you know, committed citizens. We need all those things. But you've got some specifics here, and I want to get into them that could really change this republic and bring it back to, you know, its original conscience and what it was founded on.
I think it will require education of a generation, starting in our schools, quite obviously. I learned what this country was all about in eighth grade civics in a small town in Kansas many, many, many years ago. And I think that element is somewhat lacking. I shouldn't say that till I've done a survey of public education in America, but I think the teaching of the fundamentals of what it means to be an American and who we are, and resurrecting this ideal of the republic and the principles upon which it's founded, would be a starting point. There is a new organization that I have joined called Issue One, which is meant to rally grassroots support against the corruption in Washington. And this is always a good sign. My whole history has been, I guess, what you'd call grassroots politics. And when people get aroused enough, they're either going to get angry and follow Trump, or they're going to get angry and do something constructive.
A lot of them are getting angry and turning out in massive numbers for Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
He's drawing big crowds.
That's true. But there's a history to that. Even, as you remember, Howard Dean a few years ago had the same phenomenon for a while, a lot of intense emotion and passion that didn't quite last very long. And then there have been other instances of that in the past as well.
Much of that intense passion came from Howard himself after that victory. I mean, and there again is the media's role. I mean, they played up his jumping up and down and so forth and made it into kind of a circus sort of thing. We're talking with Gary Hart. His new book is called The Republic of Conscience. And the question, I certainly welcome you, our listeners, to join us. This is an idealistic book, let me put it that way, and I think you don't necessarily blanch from that characterization, but it's talking about the time to renew the principles upon which this republic was founded. And my question to you as our listeners would be, are we too far away from those ideals? Have we passed the mark, jumped the shark, whatever you want to call it, or can we bring it back? And if we can bring it back, and we're talking about, you know, special interests particularly, but so many of these other things like the surveillance state and America going the wrong way in terms of foreign interventions and so forth. What ways, what methods, what means can be actually employed or exercised? I think it's one of the most important questions that we as citizens can deal with. Let me tell you how you can participate in this conversation. We welcome your involvement. You can also raise questions or comments in general, talking about the presidential race and a number of other things. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement, so again, feel free to join us again at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or simply put your thoughts, your questions, your comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Gary Hart, former U.S. Senator, author of Republic of Conscience, our guest this hour. Stay tuned. We'll hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Gary Hart, former senator from the state of Colorado, former presidential candidate who stood up tall and said, I'm not accepting any PAC money. And now he's written a new book, one of many books that he's written, this one called The Republic of Conscience, where he talks about really taking back the ideals upon which this republic was founded and getting away from the special interests that pretty much have much to say and much to do with how pork is made and how legislation gets through and often how policies are made. So let's bring you into this conversation. Let's begin with Ron. Ron, you're on.
Thank you. I'm in Novato and I'm originally out of San Francisco, and with Global Garden Projects for some decades, we focused on the toxins in the area. Now we're talking about products that are politically influenced and regulations that are reportedly safe, such as pesticides and herbicides and glyphosate, that are found not to be safe, But the regulations allow for testing levels that, in fact, say they're safe, but don't allow for lower testing levels that would actually demonstrate that these products bioaccumulate in human bodies and therefore trigger cancer and disease.
And the question?
The question is, how do we get at the politics that actually controls the regulations that, that present consumer products that are not truly safe, buyer's biased products?
Well, it's a question I always faced in office, the how-to question. How do we do this? How do we do that? I hate to sound trite, but when we still have a chance when citizens get frustrated enough and let that frustration be known to those they vote for or vote against or change them, they can influence policy, not only legislative policy, but regulatory policy as well. As you well know, in the age of Nader and beyond, citizen organizations, consumer organizations have had an enormous impact on work safety, on consumer product safety, on a whole range of issues. Now, when the right is ascending, a lot of those regulations get changed or reduced. And we go through these cycles of, in the consumer level, at least environmental level and other things, of regulating and deregulating, regulating and deregulating. And it makes people looking at this country from abroad think we're adolescents because we can't seem to reach agreement and on anything and make it stick. But the pendulum goes back and forth between if you will, shorthand liberal and conservative, and perceived liberals want to improve these kinds of regimes, and conservatives want to deregulate, and the country can't seem to make up its mind.
We had Charles Murray on recently. He's yes. calling for massive deregulation.
Yes.
You know, and it keeps shifting back and forth, as you say.
It's an anti-government mood. Fed in part by Mr. Murdoch and those who work with and for him. And it's a period in that we're going through. But what happens usually is that there's some catastrophe among school children or workers or commuters or something else, and there's a hue and cry, why? How did this happen? Why did we let this happen? Often the people hewing and crying voted for people who said, when I'm in office, I'm going to deregulate. So you can't have it both ways.
Same thing with, things are very reactive in terms of change. And it's the same thing that comes to mind when a terrible tragedy occurred in that schoolhouse of Massachusetts with those children slaughtered. There was a lot of talk for at least some kind of legislation.
Yes.
And nothing got through.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about special interests, of course, you have to see the NRA really at the top.
Yeah. Well, what complicates things is we have a system of government, in theory at least, by the founders, of a commonwealth. That is to say, we own things in common, a lot of things, including in the western part of the country, in my part of the country, public lands, public resources, minerals and timber, and recreational. And there's yet another new movement to turn over the ownership of public lands to the state. And everybody knows what that means because the state legislature will privatize it overnight. And now, again, why we can't reach a balance point where the people of the United States say, we want public ownership of public lands properly administered. We don't want them privatized. Let's forget about it and don't bring it up all the time. The conservative elements in the country don't give up.
Let me bring in more of our callers. We go next to Robert. Robert, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Tonight, Bernie Sanders is having an organizing event in all 50 states at 3,500 locations, 100,000 people have signed up, and they will be talking about what to do in the coming campaign and solutions for this country. This event is exactly the kind of alternative that people have been looking for, but is little mentioned in the media, namely so many publications, for example, the New York Times, seem to dismiss that there's any alternative to super PACs and billionaire fundraising. But this event tonight is the best example of showing that there is an alternative, and that's regular people getting involved and donating money. He's already received hundreds of thousands of donations, averaging $35 apiece. And I wondered if the senator would comment on this campaign in greater depth.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, I'm very familiar with it. Older listeners may recall that as a young man, I worked for a candidate called George McGovern, who was, I wouldn't say he was the Bernie Sanders of 72, but he represented an anti-war, pro-civil rights point of view that many considered far left and so forth and so on. And of course, later in the general election campaign, he was labeled by Richard Nixon and those around him as a candidate of acid, amnesty, and abortion. So painted into a corner and lost most of the country. I would hope if Senator Sanders gets the Democratic nomination, that does not happen to him. But I can tell you that the Roger Ailes of the world are already putting together media programs to paint Bernie Sanders as a far-left socialist, out of the mainstream, blah, blah, blah.
Well, there's the problem. When I interviewed Senator Sanders, I said to him, the label socialist, I mean, this is still anathema to many Americans. And he said, but I'm a democratic socialist. I'm like the Scandinavian versions of socialists and so forth. But people get very frightened when they hear that word and when they hear talk about those with a lot of income getting 95% tax on their income and so forth, immediately they draw the quarters back.
Yep. It's true. The political press, predictably at this stage in a national election race, it happens every 4 years, are trying to pick the winners and saying it's going to be Mrs. Clinton and then who is it going to be on the other side? And that gives them a lot to work with, and fascination with Trump and
Horse race stuff.
Yeah, filling up 24/7 broadcast time. They've got to talk about something, I guess. So recycling Trump stories over and over again and missing, I think, what may be an interesting story on the Democratic side, and that is that the more, as this caller indicated, the more public support Senator Sanders gets, the more influence that will have on Mrs. Clinton. She will have to take account of that element of the party.
She's going to have to move more to the left because not only of Senator Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, I think, too. Yeah.
Yes. There is I don't want to quarrel about ideologies, but I am so frustrated with left-right because these are shifting, changing positions, and it depends on what the issue is, whether it's left or right.
Well, I'm looking at your book to some extent in terms of what you put forward here. It almost sounds like a platform. I mean, you use the word manifesto. A manifesto could be, or a platform it could be, but a lot of it is traditional democratic ideals and liberal ideals.
Well, but applied to a set of new realities, the 21st century is in dramatic ways different from the 1990s. And one of the things that's of concern to many people is if Mrs. Clinton wins the presidency, will she bring back the same people into administrative positions that were in the first two Clinton administrations? Will they maintain their own networks, what they have in Washington, bring their old Rolodexes and their old policies? And I don't want to be the critic of the Clinton campaign, but I would just emphasize that 2016 is a light year in terms of the world and American economy and foreign policy, a world away from the Clinton years of the 1990s. So what we all hope to hear from her is not how she's different from her husband, but does she realize that the second decade of the 21st century is dramatically different from the one when she was in the White House?
When she gives a speech, a major speech on economic reform, and the media is covering Trump. Right. And that's pretty much how it operates right. at this point. But is it fair to say that the Clinton people and the Jeb Bush people have the same Rolodex, same advisors, same money people? I mean,
I think that's
part of the home?
I think so. Now, in her defense, if she were to point out all the 25-year-olds and 27-year-olds who are working in her campaign. And they would be brought into White House staff and other departmental staffs, but not in policy positions. So there is so much talent, so much creativity in this country outside Washington that the best thing she could do is not name names, but say, I'm going to look for new ideas and new people with new ideas and energy. And promote fusion, for example. And you could just list 100 things like that to give the idea that she's not going back to the same policy groups.
Talking with former Senator Gary Hart, his new book, The Republic of Conscience. And let's go to another caller. Neil, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, I'd like to make a correction to what Senator Hart just said. One of the reasons McGovern was attacked was that he refused to tackle the problems of human rights in communist countries under any circumstances, and he seemed to be against just about any conceivable defense policy. I don't see how people can be expected to accept that automatically. In the meantime, I'd like to know what Senator Hart would feel about a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, and how he feels about restoring Glass-Steagall, if that's possible.
Three questions. I'm a little unclear on the first statement about human rights.
I think the main thing that's managed to sink the McGovern campaign was, again, notions of economic equality or trying to move toward economic equality. But let's go to the second and third one on
that. Well, okay. I hope I'm not giving the impression that I support a foreign policy not based on promotion of human rights. Let's get that taken care of. Yes, we should try to have a constitutional amendment. It's not going to happen. We need to change three or four justices, get another case before the court so they can do what they've done in the past, whether Dred Scott or any other bad decisions, and reverse themselves. That has happened in a number of items in the past, and it will happen. I just hope I live long enough to see it. And the third question was the third.
Neil wanted to know what else did you ask, Neil? I'm sorry,
Glass-Steagall.
Oh yeah, Glass-Steagall. Absolutely,
big mistake that occurred. Correct me if I'm wrong. In the Clinton administration, deregulation of the financial sector, and as Senator Warren has pointed out, it was disastrous, and it should never have happened.
Neil, we thank you for the call, and we'll go to another caller right forthwith here, and that's you, Karen. Welcome.
Hi. I would like to know about the Hastert rule, which is an informal rule that was applied in the mid-'80s, and I think that it has really distorted policy and has detracted from the ability of the public to influence policy. Basically, to summarize, the Hastert rule is an informal rule applied only by the Republican majority speaker that says that the only potential legislation that's brought to a full vote of the House is legislation that has been pre-approved by the majority of the Republican Party. And therefore, what it means is that the whole country is beholden to the majority of the Republican Party, because if it doesn't pass the majority rule, it's not even brought to a full vote of the House, and therefore it doesn't pass the House. In my view, this really distorts the balance of power. It gives far more power to the Republicans to block any legislation, even if it's legislation that's supported by the vast majority of Democrats and a sizable minority of the Republicans. It just simply never come to a vote.
Karen, you've given a very good description of the Hastert rule, and one ought to take in mind the fact that Denny Hastert was just a few ways away from the presidency and at that time was paying blackmail money, but that's another story indeed. But Senator Hart, let's get you to weigh in on the Hastert rule.
Well, the caller is exactly right, but it's a symptom of a broader problem that we haven't discussed, and I frankly didn't discuss enough in this 200-page book, And that is the polarization of this country between red and blue. That's all happened in the last 25 years, largely, almost exclusively as a result of state legislative gerrymandering. That is to say, politicizing the boundaries of congressional districts and rendering 80% of the country or more either red or blue. Now, I happen to be in one of those five or six remaining purple states that seems to go back and forth, and it's kind of the way the country used to be almost exclusively. Now, you could count in the old days, that is 40s, 50s, maybe even 60s, Illinois was solidly Democratic, New York was solidly Democratic, California became solidly Democratic, the South moved from Democratic to Republican under President Nixon. But even more insidiously is the gerrymandering, political gerrymandering, that has turned the Congress into, again, 80+% either one thing or the other, which means that in so-called safe Democratic or Republican districts, if you win the nomination and incumbents routinely win the nomination, you've won the election. So there is no competition that no forcing people into a moderate position to get a majority of votes in their districts or their states. And that more than anything else has led to the polarization of this country.
Well, and don't forget the Tea Party, which shifted things even more in terms of,
yes.
And by the way, Gary Hart's new book, again, is called The Republic of Conscience. Let me just say, I've been talking about the manifesto here. He calls for renewed investment in the private sector, continued innovation in government and private laboratories, a rebuilt public education system, simpler and fairer taxes, dramatic action on climate protection, and increased international cooperation on confinement of conflict, which will help create economic growth and opportunity and make the United States more secure. Let me go to some of your online comments here. Here's a listener who writes, the secret to reducing the money in our election campaigns, just adopt the British system. Eliminate fixed date elections when there is a lack of confidence in the government. Dissolve Congress and schedule an election 6 weeks later. How much money can you spend in 6 weeks as opposed to 4 years? Candidates spend 4 years running for president. You can spend a lot of money in 4 years.
Problem with that is, and it's a question that arises a lot, it virtually eliminates so-called dark horse or less well-known candidates who need the time to travel the country and get better known. That was my experience in 83, 84. If it had been a six-week campaign, the nomination would have been foregone.
Another listener comment, the Bipartisan Debate Commission is a private corporation designed to exclude everyone except the two parties. How corrupt is that? Anyone on enough ballots to win the Electoral College is qualified. And Phil writes, the USA is a republic. The people elect their government representatives in a democratic voting process. The USA is not a democracy in which the popular vote elects top officials. The existence of the Electoral College keeps the USA a republic. In either system of governance, money buys all the political power, making corporations people. Corporate power is political power in a globalized economy. Corporate stability supersedes national identity, and that's why money talks. A lot of the opinions here, Senator. Here's mm-hmm. Alfred, who says, certainly one of the most pernicious elements of the rampant corruption in our government process is the great number of bills favoring commercial interests that are written by the lobbyists themselves and then presented to a friendly congressman to be offered up to Congress for a
vote. That's absolutely true.
One other email here. This is Tess, who says, as a young person, I have absolutely lost faith in our government. That idealistic view of America that I learned in grade school has completely dissipated. It does not surprise me that there is government surveillance. It does not surprise me that lobbyists have their hands in all the politicians' pockets. And it does not surprise me that our government is failing its people. I do not believe that the politicians and the leaders of our government have our best interests at heart.
You see, it's that attitude, and I understand it because I hear it a lot, that caused me to write this book. This isn't a negative book. This is a book that ends up with promise and with hope because as I say in the last line of the book, the way I know I'm an idealist is because I'm an American. And the most eminent early American historian Gordon Wood, whom I quote in the book, gives a comment on the back of the book saying, I'm an idealist but not a utopian. So I would say to young people, as John Kennedy said to my generation, do something for your country. You can rescue this country. It's up to you because you're going to inherit this country. And this book wasn't meant to discourage people from participating. It was meant to insist that people do participate and demand a better government.
Comment from a listener on our Facebook page. This is Wendy who writes, at a Netroots convention of liberals, I asked the speaker why, if we own the airwaves, we couldn't require licensed stations to have designated free time for candidates. I was told it was a freedom of speech issue that the Supreme Court would never allow. And this from liberals. What would Senator Hart's answer be?
Well, that's not – I disagree. I don't know who made that statement, but that's just flat wrong. It's not an issue for the Supreme Court. Networks is – to repeat the point, networks are licensed by the government of the United States to operate on the public airwaves. We own the airwaves. The networks don't own them.
I think she's confusing Citizens United with the airwaves.
I think that's true.
Let me bring some more callers in here, and we'll go to David. David, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment. If the Democrats as a whole continue with the Clinton bashing, they got to be careful what they wish for because they're going to hand the White House to the Republicans, in my view. And if Bernie Sanders is as much of a socialist as he claims to be, then that's going to be it. It's going to be over. So anyway, thank you for taking that call. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Well, whatever bashing is going on, I don't count me among the bashers. I've known Secretary Clinton and President Clinton for well over 40 years and admire and respect them both and do believe that she is a leader of our party and a potential leader of the country and deserves attention and respect, but not a coronation. The decision about who should lead a party, which is the first step in electing a president, is a serious one. And there are different points of view of what the Democratic Party stands for. Indeed, there is even more difference about what the Republican Party stands for. And that's why you've got 16 candidates. But I think there's a difference between people disagreeing or criticizing Mrs. Clinton and bashing her. I think a lot of the bashing's coming from media on the right.
When Senator Sanders was here in studio, I asked him directly about Secretary Clinton, and he said, I don't say things in opposition to people I run against. I just don't. I've never done that in my political career, which I gave him a great deal of respect for. But the question always comes up with Hillary Clinton, and you've said you have a lot of admiration and respect for both Clintons, but people keep asking this question, what did she accomplish as Secretary of State? What do you see as her accomplishments as Secretary of State?
Well, she certainly was visible and traveled a lot and communicated with world leaders in person on a regular basis. She logged a lot of miles. She did not, as John Kerry has done, sit at a table for week after week, month after month, and negotiate an agreement that is as serious as the Iran agreement. And I think that's what people are – the contrast people are drawing.
Well, that, and let me just add to that, the fact that we were supposed to have a new set of relations with the Russians and then things started deteriorating terribly, of course.
Yeah, we could spend – I've spent a lot of time in Russia and concerned with Russia, and we could spend another hour on that. I think the U.S.-Russian relationship, albeit President Putin is not our idea of a Democrat, could have been handled much, much differently and much better.
So logging miles is mainly bona fides for Secretary Clinton.
She spoke out for women and women's rights all around the world, and that's a plus. And I think there were occasions at conferences and so forth. She did a lot of speaking where she held her own on U.S. interests and what we stood for and so on. And that's all to her credit. But I think what this kind of comment suggests is what was the big achievement?
Here's Marie-Louise. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have been thinking of the school in San Francisco where when they pledge allegiance, they say we pledge allegiance to the whole world. And I would like to kind of tie that in a little bit with people who are so incredibly afraid of socialism. because I think that we live in this world, most people know that we're all connected, but that fear of socialism keeps on being there like a, some sort of a bad wound that forever is open. So it is the Harvey Milk School where they do this Pledge of Allegiance, and I think that is something to go forward with for our children, to pledge allegiance to the whole world.
All right. I can hear the right responding to that. And, but I thank you for the call.
That comment raises an interesting observation, and that is that the world is coalescing. Globalization is bringing all of us, and information, bringing us all closer together. But at the same time, nations are disintegrating under the pressure of ethnic nationalism, tribalism, and so forth. So it's part of the confusion in world affairs is we're two directly opposite things are happening simultaneously.
Gary Hart, always good to have you on. Thank you
Great
so much.
Great pleasure.
For being with
Thank
us.
You.
Again, Gary Hart, new book, The Republic of Conscience. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online. We invite you to do that on our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply again click on this segment. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking in this hour with Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hitzig. He's written a book about really the cyclotron and the whole beginning of nuclear physics and where it goes back to scientific experiment with, well, nuclear physicists right out of UC Berkeley. In our opening hour, we're going to be talking about this ongoing controversy over hunting big game that resulted as a shooting of a lion and killing of a lion in Zimbabwe, a protected lion. Forum is produced by Irene Gucci and Tina Larberg and Vinnie Tong. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Forum senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.